Jesus said to them and to us, if you want to follow me, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Deny yourself. Reject yourself. Forsake yourself. Ignore yourself. All those words mean the same thing, come from the same Greek term. Deny, reject, forsake, ignore yourself. A few chapters previously in Matthew 10, we're told that Jesus said this to his disciples, whoever loves father or mother more than me isn't worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me isn't worthy of me. Deny yourself and everyone else. Reject yourself, forsake yourself, ignore yourself and everybody else. Now, for some of you, you might be going, well, of course, Elaine, I've read that before. And some of you may be like where I've been this week going, oh, Jesus, this goes against everything. Be the best you can be, we're told. Be the best version of yourself, we're told. According to a company called Market Research, the self-improvement field, which includes things like self-help books and personal coaching, self-improvement apps, and motivational speakers, is somewhere in the range of a $12 billion a year industry in the U.S. My guess is probably Canada isn't much different. $12 billion, all about getting people to be the best they can be, or the best version of themselves, all about self-improvement and self-actualization. Now, let me say that spending time and energy on self-improvement and personal development isn't a bad thing in and of itself. There's nothing wrong with doing what we can to be the best versions of ourselves. I think that's an admirable thing. I'm a firm believer in things like education and self-awareness, in developing our God-given gifts and our skills, and overcoming the self-consciousness or the lack of confidence that keeps us from impacting the world and embodying Jesus to the fullest extent that we can. All these things are good, and all of these things are important to do in this life. In my own life, I've been helped hugely by courses and mentoring that helped me understand myself, that helped me grow in my areas of strength. I've invested thousands of dollars in things like leadership development and overcoming or at least managing my weaknesses and flaws. I'm still working hard at being a better person, a more whole person. And I can't for a moment imagine that God doesn't want us to live up to all the potential that he put inside of us. I can't imagine that he doesn't want us to know and live up to our capacity in terms of our strengths and our gifts and our callings. All of that is good. Except Jesus said, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, reject themselves, forsake themselves, ignore themselves. Now, I don't think that Jesus' words literally mean we're supposed to ignore ourselves by ignoring our need for self-improvement or our need to develop our strengths and our gifts and our skills that God has given us. But I do think that Jesus was only too aware of how easy it is for all of those things to take over, to take all our attention, all of our time, all of our energy, all of our money. I think Jesus realized how quickly and how subtly we find these honorable pursuits sucking us in until the only thing we're aware of is ourselves. It starts with the best motivations. It starts with recognizing that you have worth, that God has gifted you, that you have something to contribute to the world. This is also Jesus' message. It's Jesus' message over and over and over again to all of the people that the world said, you're nothing, you have nothing to offer, you're nothing but space takers. And Jesus came and he said, no, you're part of God's kingdom. You're God's beloved children. It's a good thing. We know that this is true. So is Jesus saying, no, don't live up to that, ignore that, forget what I said before? No, I don't think that he's saying that. I think, though, he's realizing it's like all the sin in the world, things that start with the most honorable intentions can slowly be twisted. That's what sin does. All it does is just twist good things and make them not so good anymore. It twists our honorable intentions, our desire to be the best that we can be, to honor God in the way that we live, to grow our gifts, to make a difference in the world. It takes all of those things and it just twists it, often in a way that we can't even really notice it's being twisted until much further down the road. And before we know, all of this focus on being the best that I can be turns out to be me worshiping myself. It becomes me sacrificing for what? For me. For my growth. For the realization of my potential. And almost before we even know what's happening, we're consumed. We're consumed by the pursuit of our own betterment. And the more we pursue it, the more convinced we become that we, that I, that you are not enough. Or at least that we're not yet enough. But that we can become enough if we just work hard enough at it. If we just read another book or take another course or cook more or travel more or get married or have children or lose our spouse or lose some weight or get better clothes or a better job or you fill in the blank. This is what it does. It takes this honorable desire to be the best versions of ourselves. It turns us inward so that we become more and more focused on ourselves and consumed by ourselves. We find ourselves sacrificing not for the world, not for God, but for ourselves and our own betterment, because suddenly we have bought into this idea that we are not enough, that we are not worthy of attention and love, that we can't possibly be God's beloved child until we live up to his expectations and the potential that he has for it. But here's the thing, even with Jesus, one of my favorite images of Jesus is him coming up out of the waters of baptism. He hasn't done anything yet. He has just been born and grown up and done whatever people did in that day and age as a Hebrew man growing up. And he goes down to the river and he's baptized in the river. And at that moment, he's dedicating his life to God. He's saying, this ministry that you have put before me, this destiny, this calling that you have placed before me, which we know ultimately leads to the cross and his resurrection and the salvation of all humanity. He hasn't done any of that yet. He hasn't healed anybody yet. He hasn't shown anything yet that makes him worthy of praise and honor and glory and worship. And as he comes up out of the water, the voice of God speaks out of heaven and says, this is my son, my beloved, in whom I am well pleased. Note that those weren't the words spoken when Jesus finished it all. It wasn't Jesus hanging on the cross. He'd done it all. And all of a sudden God says, well done. Now you are my beloved son. It was before all of that. For anybody who has ever had a child or loved a child, you look at that infant who hasn't done anything, can't do anything, doesn't give you a darn thing, and you love them anyways. That's the way that God loves us. But the thing is, when we focus all this energy on becoming better people, which in and of itself is not a problem, and it starts to suck us in so that our focus becomes all on us, there's a twist that happens. It's not about, man, God loves me, and so I want to honor him by being the best that I can be in my life. It twists and it gets all monstery because it becomes this thing where it says, I'm not good enough yet, but if I can just take this course, or if I can just change this about me, or if I can just grow in this way, or if I can just participate in this development, then I will become good enough. This is the lie of the Garden of Eden. It's the lie that the snake told Eve. He said to her, eat the fruit and you'll be like God. You'll know good and evil. You'll be all that you can be. The best version of yourself, the best you can be, Satan said. Just take a bite. Eat the fruit, because without it, who you are isn't enough. You could be so much more, Eve. You should be so much more. Do you hear how the lie works, how it all gets twisted? But in Genesis 1, when God created men and women, this is what we read. God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created the male and female, he created them. And God saw that everything he had made, and indeed it was very good. Before anything had been done, just lying there in the dirt, God saw what he had made, and it was very good. Psalm 139, this fantastic psalm, which can give you a little bit of a complex because it's kind of a little bit of the big eye in the sky watching down on you and sees everything that you do and you can't get away with anything. But it's meant to be this extraordinary psalm of comfort. And at verse 13 in Psalm 139, the psalmist writes this: "It was you," speaking to God, "it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, that I know very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Before I was even born, God knew me. Before you were even born, before you had breathed your first breath of life, God knew you and God loved you." In Romans 5:8, Paul writes that God proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. The whole Christian story, the whole narrative about Jesus going to the cross and dying and being buried and then rising up from the dead again, that whole story that tells us that God loved us so much that he couldn't see us separated from him or separated from each other anymore, that he wanted to correct what had gone wrong in the beginning when sin entered the world, that whole story is initiated not because we got better, because we suddenly deserved it, because people had worked hard enough at improving themselves that God said, okay, now it's worth investing in these people. No, it happened before all of that. It happened while we were still sinners, while we were still ripping each other apart, while we were still engulfed in our own narcissism and our own selfishness and our own violence and our own hate. In the midst of all of that, that's when God sent his son. Jesus said, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves. Not because we don't need to improve, not because we shouldn't strive to be the best version of ourselves, but because none of that dictates our worth. Your worth as a human being, as a child of God, is not even one tiny part connected to you being great, to you growing as a human being, to you becoming all the things that you could become. We are deeply loved by God before we even take a breath in the world. We're deeply loved by God regardless of whether or not we ever read a self-help book or go on a diet or invest in developing our gifts or skills or figure out how to capitalize on our strengths and manage our weaknesses. Jesus said, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves. Let them stop with all the focus and attention on themselves and instead focus on me. Because the irony of it is, the more inward focus we become, the more we focus on our own betterment, the more aware we become of all of that's wrong with us. Because that's what Satan does. He wants to convince us we don't have worth. He wants us to convince us that we're not enough, that we're not worthy, that we have to do more and more and more. And if we're looking at ourselves, we're not looking at Jesus, because Jesus' message is something different. Jesus' message is, you are my sister, you are my brother. God's message is, you are my child, you are my beloved. I have loved you since before you were even born. He doesn't say you have to deny yourself because he's got some kind of masochistic ideals for the human race. He says you have to deny yourselves. Because in taking your focus off yourself and putting your focus on me, that's where you will discover your worth. That's where you will know what it is to be truly, deeply loved. I remember that when I was learning to drive, one of the most important lessons that we learned in driver's ed was that you always had to look where you wanted to go because that's where the car would be. So if we were driving down the road and we got distracted by something on the sidewalk, we'd find ourselves on the sidewalk. If we got distracted by oncoming traffic, we would find ourselves in oncoming traffic. Speaking personally, if we got distracted by a snowbank on the side of the road, we would find ourselves in the snowbank. Took me a long time to learn to drive. We were warned of the dangers of not looking far enough ahead and of instead looking just at the hood of the car. If our focus was so close, was just at the hood of the car, there was going to be an accident. You're going to crash the car. When Jesus said, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, I think he was saying that if we want to follow Jesus, we have to be looking at Jesus, not at ourselves. I think it's as simple as that. It makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, just like with driving, we're going to end up wherever we're looking. And if we're focused on looking at ourselves, then that's where we're going to end up, completely consumed by the self. Don't forget ever that Satan's one desire is just to destroy us, to wreck us, to ruin us. If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves. I so wish Jesus had stopped there. He didn't have to. That sentence is great. He could have just said to his disciples, if you want to be my followers, deny yourselves. He could have unpacked it a bit. I think he did in the way that he lived his life. Yes, it's hard to deny myself. It's hard to reject, to forsake, to ignore myself. It takes vigilance. It takes honesty. It takes other people speaking into my life. If I'm going to keep my eye focused on Jesus instead of on myself, if I'm going to avoid being consumed by my own narcissism. Oh, but Jesus didn't stop there, did he? He added to the self-denial because, like, that wasn't hard enough. He added a truly terrifying metaphor that for his original disciples wouldn't have even been a metaphor, but would have been a literal, terrifying reality. If any want to become my followers, he said, let them deny themselves and take up their cross. We need to pause here and remember what the cross is. When you pull that little silver or gold necklace off of wherever you hang it when you're not wearing it and you put it on, that's not what Jesus was talking about. When we take one of those car bumper stickers or decals that's in the fish shape that's supposed to proclaim that we are a Christian and we put it on our car and somebody doesn't like that, that's not taking up your cross. Crucifixion was the number one method of torture and execution in the Roman Empire. The main roads in the Roman Empire were lined with crucifixes, with people in various states of death and dying and decomposing. It was a way to make sure that you instilled horrendous fear in people so that they wouldn't rebel, so that they wouldn't stand up against the powers that be, that they would not choose to take on the Roman government. It was a horrendous thing. What happened for Jesus, if we take his account, first he was beaten. He was beaten so that his back, his entire back, would have been raw and bloody and incredibly painful. And then what they would have done is they would have taken the cross beam. So it wouldn't have been the whole cross. It would have been the cross beam. Our cross is lovely. It's really heavy if you've ever tried to move it. But it's nothing compared to the kind of crosses, the crucifixes that the Roman government had. That cross beam, it's estimated, probably weighed about 100 pounds. Just pause there and think about that. 100 pounds that you would have to carry across your shoulders, which were raw and so painful from already having been tortured. And you had to carry that all the way out to the place of crucifixion. The journey would have been excruciating. If you could even carry it that far, we're told, our legend tells us that Jesus stumbled along the way. because it was so heavy and it was so hard. There would have been crowds standing all around, jeering and yelling and mocking, probably throwing things at him. And when he got there, they would have affixed it to the big vertical beam. And to make sure that he didn't fall off, they didn't just nicely, gently tie him to it. They used stakes, they used nails to hold his hands and to hold his feet in place. And he would have been hanging like this. He would have been very hard to breathe. I don't know if you've ever found it difficult to catch your breath. If you've ever found yourself going, I can't quite fill my lungs up with air. That's what it would have been like consistently. Sometimes people hung on a cross for days before they finally died. And how did they die? They died usually from suffocation because they just couldn't catch their breath. Not a quick suffocation like a plastic bag put over your head, but a slow, agonizing, tortured crucifixion. When Jesus said to his disciples, if you want to be my followers, you have to take up your cross. This is what they knew that meant. We forget that. We forget what crucifixion is because it's not a reality in our lives. But crucifixion was a reality for Jesus and for his original disciples. It's so easy for us to slide past these words as if they have no relevance for us. They speak of martyrdom, which isn't something that most of us have to face. The likelihood that any of us will have to suffer like Jesus suffered or to die because we're a Christian, a Jesus follower, let's face it, it's slim to none. Sure, Jesus and his followers must deny themselves and take up their cross, but is that still relevant for us? What does it mean for us in this day and age and in this part of the world? One of the ways that we've tried to make Jesus' words relevant is by expanding the meaning of the cross to include any and all suffering that we might endure. Our illnesses, our pain, our griefs, all of it gets thrust under this singular heading of suffering. We say of our disease or of our family conflict, I guess this is the cross I must bear. We say of our broken hearts or our lost jobs, this is my cross to bear. Now, I never want to belittle human suffering. Tragedy in our world is too frequent and too widely known. Chronic pain or disease or poverty are only too real, too devastating the world over. Suffering is an ever-present reality, but this kind of suffering is not what Jesus was talking about on this occasion. After all, we know that everyone suffers, regardless of whether or not they're a follower of Jesus. It's not something unique to those who are followers of Jesus. Jesus didn't say, hey, if you want to be my follower, you're going to have to suffer in this life, but everybody else, no suffering for you. That's not what he said. So obviously he's not talking about suffering in general. I think that the key to understanding what Jesus was talking about is understanding what his cross was all about. Not just the pain and the torture of it. On the surface, his cross was about those who benefited from the status quo, ridding themselves of anyone who dared challenge the status quo. On the surface, Jesus' cross was about an empire keeping its conquered people conquered. On the surface, Jesus' cross was about silencing an agitator, a voice for the people. But Jesus' cross held even deeper meaning than all of that. It was the end. It was the loss of all the dreams Jesus' followers had for a better world. It was the shame of one who was cursed by God. It was the death of hope and the victory of violence. It was the absence of God. It was the absolute, utter ineptitude of human institutions to make the world better. Jesus carrying his cross was Jesus allowing the world to do its worst, allowing shame and violence and God's own silence to beat him down, to drag him into the dirt. Jesus carrying his cross was the most astounding act of obedience and faith in God's way that the world had ever seen. Jesus carrying his cross was not an act of defeat, but was a thundering announcement that God would and could be trusted no matter what things look like in the moment. Because don't forget that Jesus' story didn't end with the cross. He rose from the dead. All that shame, all that violence, all that sin wrapped up in the cross was defeated when Jesus rose from the dead. And with the defeat of sin came the tangible realization of God's kingdom breaking in on our world. Jesus carried his cross because it was the way ordained by God for God's purpose to be realized. Jesus carried his cross because the restoration of human relationship with God and with each other was more important than even his own life. Jesus carried his cross because that's what God asked of him. Jesus said, if you want to be my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross. In other words, let them look to Jesus, let them follow wherever he leads, regardless of how absurd or how painful or how costly it might be. Let them follow because God's way is the only way, even if his way seems impossible to bear. This is what it means to be a Christian, to be a follower or a disciple of Jesus. It means denying, it means rejecting, forsaking, ignoring oneself. It means going wherever Jesus leads, regardless of the cost. If anyone want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. How do we know where Jesus is leading? How do I know what it is that Jesus wants of me? First thing, we look at the Gospels, the accounts of Jesus' own life in history. We look to the epistles, what we call the letters in the Bible, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, all those letters through the New Testament, to the ways that Jesus' earliest followers, the earliest churches, lived their lives and were challenged to live in ways that mirrored Jesus' life. We connect into a community of faith like this that's marked by prayer and worship and teaching, and we figure out together where Jesus is leading. If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. That's where it starts. Why? When the cross is the image of discipleship, would anyone in their right mind choose to follow Jesus? If we're taking Jesus' words seriously, why would any of us choose this? It's one thing to follow Jesus when the crowds were cheering. Remember the Palm Sunday story? He's going into Jerusalem and the crowds have lined the street and they're waving palm branches and they're lying their cloaks in the ground and they're singing, Hosanna, praise God. They're loving Jesus at that point. That's great. We could follow that Jesus, no problem. But why would we follow him to the cross? Why would we pick up our own 100-pound crossbeam and put it across our already damaged, bruised, bloody shoulders and carry it to a point of death? Why would we not just deny ourselves, but also take up the burden of a cross? I think when all is said and done, I think eventually all of us reach a point when we're forced to admit that no amount of investment in self-help and self-improvement will ever be enough to make us as awesome and extraordinary as we wish that we were. I think that's when we're finally able to see that as awesome and as extraordinary as we wish we were is exactly what God sees when he looks at us. We might see how far we have to go. God sees us as if we're already that. It's exactly what God declared us to be even before we'd taken our first breath, before we'd ever confessed or repented even our first sin. I also think that the day eventually comes for all of us when we reach a point where we're forced to admit that no political party, no human institution, no ideology or culture or belief system will ever fix our world. I'm not saying give up and don't vote or don't be involved. But it's not going to fix our world. I think that we all have to eventually face the reality that our world is broken, that the systems and the institutions of our world are broken, that the solution is never going to be of this world in our systems and our institutions, but is only and always going to be in God's kingdom, because sin infects everything, the people as well as the institutions and the system. The only way our world is fixed is through God's kingdom, which was inaugurated by Jesus, which is embodied by the church, and which is promised in full when Jesus returns. That's the solution. That's the answer to all the headings that come across your newsfeed that just make you want to crumble and roll up into the fetal position. So if getting to that place, if being part of the light of God's kingdom here and now costs me like Jesus' cross cost him, then it's worth it. If I can point people to real hope in our dark world, if I can demonstrate the genuine, unconditional love of God for all people, isn't it worth it? Isn't it worth braving whatever the cross is for you, whatever it is that you have to carry as you follow Jesus? Jesus said, if any want to be my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. It's a terrifying call. If it's not terrifying, you're missing the whole cross metaphor. Discipleship is not for the faint of heart. Following Jesus requires everything that we have and everything that we are. But in following, we get to be part of the most extraordinary thing God has ever done since he created the world. We get to be part of fixing our broken world. We get to be part of healing human relationships. We get to be part of reconnecting people with their creator who loves them beyond description. We get to be part of hope. It's the great irony of the Christian life. In denying ourselves and taking up our cross, we discover not death and pain, but the abundant life that God intended when he first created us. Yes, it's a terrifying call. But just as Jesus' cross was not the end of his story, neither is our self-denial or our cross the end of our story. Through it all, we know that God is good and faithful and will guaranteed bring his kingdom fully to earth as it was in heaven. There's another spot where Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, for I will give you rest. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. What's the yoke? It's the cross that he asks us to carry in this passage. See, because at no point are we left in our own strength to carry that cross beam when we follow Jesus. He shares the weight of it with us to the extent where he can say, my yoke is easy, my burden is light.